Good morning.
Good morning.
May it please the Court. My name is Ryan Norwood. I'm an attorney with the Federal Defender, and I represent Mr. Hibbler. In his petition, Ken Hibbler has made specific factual allegations that, if true, demonstrated that he received ineffective assistance from his plea counsel. No court has ever given Mr. Hibbler the opportunity to prove these allegations at an evidentiary hearing. This case should be remanded so that Mr. Hibbler can have the opportunity to prove his allegations.
There's an obstacle to that. He first has to establish that he meets the requirements to have an evidentiary hearing.
I believe, Judge Rawlinson, you're referring to the 2254D requirements in Pinholster?
Yes.
He needs to show that the state court decision is erroneous under either D1 or D2 based on the state court record. It's not always clear what the distinction between D1 and D2 is, but I believe that this is best seen as a D2 case. This is a case where the state court's fact-finding procedures are themselves deficient. In state court, Mr. Hibbler made the same allegations that he's now making in his federal petition about what happened with his lawyers. And rather than hold a hearing on these well-pled allegations, the state courts simply dismissed them out of hand.
So the state court made it a Strickland determination, and under a D1 setting, we would say, was the state court's application of Strickland objectively unreasonable, correct?
Yes.
And in making that determination, the state court was saying these allegations are on their face not credible, or there's no prejudice. If we look at the prejudice prong, don't we review that under D1? Because that's really a legal question as to whether there's prejudice or not.
I agree that there is a D1 aspect to this with the prejudice prong, but if you look at the Nevada Supreme Court's order, and really the lower court's order too, what they're doing is they're conducting the wrong prejudice inquiry. Mr. Hibbler is saying, this ineffective assistance I allege I received, I would not have entered my plea and I would have instead elected to go to trial. What the courts were doing is conducting a different inquiry into whether or not Mr. Hibbler would have ultimately been successful at that trial if he had it. The way to figure that out
is... If it's an issue of law, then we can decide whether or not the ultimate determination that there was no prejudice was unreasonable, regardless of how the state court got there. If the ultimate determination was not unreasonable, then don't we have to deny the petition?
I would disagree with that. I mean, there are situations where we don't know how the state court got to where they got, and in that case, Harrington v. Richter comes into play, and we have to sort of imagine what a hypothetical court would have done.
But do we care? As long as the state court's determination was not contrary to or an unreasonable application of Supreme Court law, then the bottom line is what we look at, isn't it? Because our cases say the court doesn't even have to be aware of the Supreme Court precedent as long as the result it reaches is not unreasonable.
In a case where there is a reasoned decision from the state court, like in this one, it's more than just the bottom line that we look at. We look at the state court's actual reasoning.
Give me your best case authority to support your argument that we look beyond the result and look at the reasoning in applying D1.
I think you can look at any of a number of recent Supreme
Court
decisions.
Give me your best case that says we look beyond the result and determine whether or not the reasoning of the state court was correct. What's your best case authority for that proposition?
Just from this term, there's a case called Wenzel v. Lampert, which is a Brady case decided by the United States Supreme Court. This is a case that ultimately goes against the petitioner, that the Supreme Court says that remands it for more determinations. But if you read the decision, what everybody's talking about, the majority and the dissent, is what the state Supreme Court actually said. And the error identified in that case is that the lower court didn't read the state Supreme Court opinion properly. So the question in the case is not ultimately whether some hypothetical court could have arrived at the same decision. It's whether the state Supreme Court made this decision. And to what extent you have to look at what the decision says first and determine if that's reasonable or not. If the state Supreme Court's reasoning is unreasonable under D1 or D2, or if it's contrary to federal law, then there's nothing to defer to. Because
now, did you cite that case in your brief?
I don't believe that I did. I think it was decided after the briefing.
So that's your most important case, and you didn't cite it in your brief?
It was decided after the briefing. I could go through.
That's okay. You don't have that much time.
Okay, let me ask you another question. So there are three in your brief. There are three on appeal. There are three different ineffective assistance of counsel claims. And did the state court on each of them make a ruling on prejudice, or was it primarily based on not deficient?
They purported to decide both for each ground.
And so can you just go through what was the state court's prejudice ruling? What specifically did the state court say on the prejudice, no prejudice?
Well, with ground one, for example, which is the claim that has to do with the advice that Mr. Hibbler received from his plea counsel, what the state court says is, well, you haven't proved that this defense that you wanted to present would have been successful at a trial. That's not the correct prejudice inquiry under Hill v. Lockhart. The question is, you know, but for the ineffective assistance that the client alleges he received, would he have not taken the plea? And that's the point that Mr. Hibbler is making over and over again in his pleadings. He understands perfectly well that there is a risk to having this conviction overturned. But Mr. Hibbler wanted to take that risk. He wanted to be able to present a defense to the jury. And his allegation is that by telling him that he had absolutely no defense in absolute terms, that his lawyer took that away from him. And eventually he didn't have the opportunity to make that decision to have the trial.
So you're arguing that the state court made an unreasonable application of Strickland under D1. Is that correct?
In that instance, yes.
Okay. And then under D2, we would have to say that the state court's failure to have an evidentiary hearing on his claim that the lawyers told him there was no insanity defense in Nevada was an unreasonable determination of the facts. Is that correct?
Well, not just no insanity defense, but no defense at all. I mean, even if he couldn't have presented a legal insanity defense under Nevada law, the state still had the burden to prove the mens rea of the offense beyond a reasonable doubt.
But that's not a defense. That's the state's obligation. So with no insanity defense, what would the defense have been?
Defense can have sometimes a narrow meaning and sometimes a broader meaning. We can talk about defense in the sense of, you know, a defense like insanity or self-defense or something like that. What Mr. Hibbler is talking about is a broader definition
of
defense.
Putting the state to its burden of proof.
Yes.
As a defense. Is that what your argument is?
His lawyers are telling him that there is no defense to this. And the fair interpretation of that is not just that there isn't some legal defense that you can present, but there's no way at all that you can win the trial. That's what Mr. Hibbler
And there's evidence in the record, I guess, in the sentencing memorandum that, in fact, the lawyers were pursuing or developing information about his mental capacity possibly bearing on insanity. So could is it unreasonable for the state court to determine that it does, in light of the state of the record, it doesn't need to have an evidentiary hearing?
The claim here, Judge,
adds to that question on that same subject. What evidence, apart from the petitioner's own allegations, that counsel told him he had no defense, is there any other evidence in the record before the state court?
Should I address Judge Ikuda's question
and
first?
Or? Address well, Judge Nelson.
All right. Please address, I was trying to piggyback on it. Please address hers first and then mine second.
Okay. I think I can address both in the same answer. I think this is not necessarily a claim that the lawyer's investigation was in itself deficient. There is some indication in the record that the lawyers conducted some kind of investigation, and they knew that there was something that could have been done insofar as the defense that Mr. Hibbler wanted to present, which makes their alleged advice all the more unreasonable. The conversation that we're talking about here, the conversation between Mr. Hibbler and his lawyers, is something that doesn't otherwise appear in the record. What we have is Mr. Hibbler's representation as to what happened in that conversation.
And that's the only thing in the record, is that correct on that subject?
It's the only thing on the subject, the precise advice that he received, but in many instances it's the only thing that we would expect to have there. My point is that what we need to do is to have an evidentiary hearing to develop this fact so that if there's any contrary evidence to what Mr. Hibbler is saying, and right now there is none, so that we can figure out what actually happened here.
But you have to establish that the state court was objectively unreasonable in not holding an evidentiary hearing, right?
What I would have to establish...
Because otherwise, sending it back to the district court does nothing under Cullen v. Pinholster.
What I would have to establish is that the fact-finding procedure used by the state court was unreasonable under Taylor v. Maddox. And the argument here is that by just summarily resolving these allegations without allowing him to develop at a hearing, the fact-finding was unreasonable. That in and of itself constitutes an error under D2.
All right, counsel, you've exceeded your time. We will give you 1 minute for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor.
We'll hear from the state.
Good morning, Your Honors. Good morning. My name is Jared Frost. I'm with the Office of the Attorney General in Nevada. It's my great pleasure to represent the respondents in this action. This case presents three claims of ineffective assistance of counsel. And while there are separate allegations of attorney error as to each claim, the petitioner has to show the same thing as to prejudice as to each of these claims, that but for counsel's actions, he would have not pled guilty, but would have insisted on going to trial. However, as this court is rightly focused on this prejudice inquiry, Hibbler's arguments on this point do not stand up to scrutiny. First of all, this is a case in which the defendant attempted to kill his 8-year-old daughter with a razor blade.
I know that was the government's theory, but the defendant's argument is that the state court's reasoning on the prejudice prong was erroneous. Is that correct? Do you agree with that?
No, Your Honor. The Nevada Supreme Court determined that there was no prejudice in this case for two reasons. First of all, that there was the defendant's only defense in this case was that he was not going to be able the state was not going to be able to prove that he had the requisite mental state because of his alleged ingestion of an anti-anxiety medication called Advian. There's almost no support for this defense in the record. In addition, Mr. Hibbler received a tremendous benefit in pleading guilty in this case. Originally charged with attempted murder, first-degree kidnapping, battery with resulting in substantial bodily harm, all with deadly weapons enhancements, Hibbler was permitted to plead to one count of child abuse resulting in substantial bodily harm, a Class B felony. It is largely because of counsel's appropriate representation in negotiating and encouraging Hibbler to accept this plea that he is a free man today. And third,
But what was the state court's reasoning? What did the state court say? Defense counsel, the opposing counsel says, well, the state court said there was no prejudice because he would have lost at trial anyway, and he says that's the wrong test. Is that correct?
The Nevada Supreme Court did discuss the likelihood or the absence of a likelihood that the defendant would have succeeded at trial. I believe, is relevant to the question and goes to the ultimate issue of whether Hibbler has established a reasonable probability that, in fact, he would have insisted on going to trial in this case. In this case, the prejudice arguments here are quite weak, and this court can and should deny the claims on that basis.
So you're saying what the state court said in effect was no rational defendant would have gone to trial given the strength of the government's case and the absence of defense, and so a rational person would have taken the plea deal under these circumstances, so no prejudice.
That's correct, and the fact that the plea deal was quite generous, that he avoided the possibility of a much harsher sentence in taking the plea. Now, Mr. Hibbler also complains at length that he was not permitted an evidentiary hearing in state court and requests that this case be remanded to the federal district court for an evidentiary hearing. This denial is, of course, reviewed under an abuse of discretion standard. And here the district court denied the request for an evidentiary hearing based on the United States Supreme Court's recent decision in Colon v. Penholster.
Right, but what defense counsel, opposing counsel is saying is that if we determine that the state court's conclusion, fact-finding, was unreasonable, then we're relieved of AEDPA deference, and we do send it back to the district court, which would just determine whether an evidentiary hearing was applicable under the Townsend v. Sane factors. So the real question is not what the district court did, but whether the state court was unreasonable or not. And so was the state court unreasonable in not engaging in an evidentiary hearing to determine whether Mr. Hibbler's claims had a basis or not?
No, Your Honor. Now, the state district court, of course, had discretion to determine based on the record that was presented to it whether an evidentiary hearing was necessary. It determined that no evidentiary hearing was necessary.
Why?
As to the first claim, it determined that Mr. Hibbler's claims were belied by the record, that his counsel told him that there was no defense to his charges under Nevada law. And, of course, as has already been pointed out, that was based on counsel's pretrial preparation in preparing an expert and preparing the defense based on these same allegations. Now, while perhaps debatable, if we don't have evidence from counsel in this case to refute what Mr. Hibbler has stated, this was at least a reasonable determination and inference based on the record that was presented to the state district court. And as well, Mr. Hibbler makes the argument that there is an exception to Colon v. Penholster when it is basically the state court's fault that the record is incomplete. Respondents do not concede that this exception exists. The only exception in Penholster that is provided for is where the state district court fails to review a claim on the merits. However, even if this exception did exist, he doesn't meet that exception. As you may remember, there was an opportunity for Hibbler to go forward on his motion to withdraw his guilty plea. Counsel was appointed to investigate whether there was a basis to go forward with that plea. When counsel reported back to the court that, in her view, there was no basis for this, Hibbler accepted her representation and went forward with sentencing. It was at that moment when, if at any time he had the opportunity to say to the court, I do not want to go forward with sentencing, I want to challenge the validity of my guilty plea, and I want to have some type of evidentiary hearing on it, that was his time to do it. Instead, he chose to go to sentencing and accepted the representatives of counsel who was standing right next to him. In addition to that, there is no request for an evidentiary hearing in the state habeas petition that he filed. There is no motion for an evidentiary hearing. And what we do have is a request in his reply, which even if it were proper, is limited to a claim that is not before this court. That request is on page 293 of the excerpt. And if there are no other questions, that concludes my presentation.
Any questions, Judge Nelson?
No, thank you.
It appears not, counsel. Thank you.
Thank you.
Rebuttal, 1 minute.
You had asked me a question earlier, Judge Rawlinson, about the case authority for the proposition I was making. I did address this point on my opening brief on page 28, footnote 14. I cited Early v. Packer and Porter v. McCollum, the proposition that we defer to a state court as far as that its own reasoning is reasonable, but the state court doesn't make a decision, then there's nothing to defer to. Or when the decision is unreasonable, there's nothing to defer to. I didn't have the chance to go into ground three, which opposing counsel brought up. This has to do the point I want to make briefly is that ground three is not duplicative of the other grounds. What Mr. Hibbler is saying, in essence, is that he was deprived of the opportunity to file a pre-sentence motion to withdraw his plea because of the ineffective advice he received from his lawyer.
But the record does show that he's standing next to the lawyer. The lawyer is right there, and the lawyer says there's no basis to withdraw the plea. And then the next question is, do you want this lawyer? And he says yes. So it's a pretty strong inference that he's on board with what you just said to the court.
The lawyer plainly misunderstands the standard for the pre-sentence motion. She seems to think you need to show manifest injustice. That's the standard for a post-conviction motion, but not for a pre-conviction motion. So we can assume that's the advice she's giving Mr. Hibbler, too. The thing about being misadvised by your lawyer is you usually don't know you're being misadvised by your lawyer at the time. So the fact that he's not speaking up then shouldn't be surprising.
Counsel, do you have the early case before you? With you? I'm curious about the language that you're relying upon.
Early v. Packer, I believe, is the case that says that.
What's the specific language that you're relying upon? Because I have that case, and I don't see anything that says we look at the reasoning of the state court to determine whether or not it met D1 or D2.
I believe what it says, and I don't have the case right in front of me, is that we defer to the state court as long as neither its reasoning nor its result is something that we can't defer to.
All right. Thank you. Thank you, counsel. Thank you to both counsel. The case just argued is submitted for decision by the court. The next case on calendar, Hamilton versus Junius, has been submitted on the briefs. The next case on calendar for argument is United States versus Bravo Cuevas.